Welcome to the first episode of Far From Home, a podcast that encourages biblical perspectives on immigration and inspires faith in action. I'm your host, Mabel Ninen, and I'm so glad you're here. A quick note about the content you can expect from Far From Home. I will be having three kinds of conversations here on this podcast. The first kind will be with immigrants or refugees. I hope listening to their testimonies will strengthen your walk with God. I also hope these episodes give you a peek into the personal lives of immigrants so you can understand their struggles and challenges and find common ground with them. The second type of conversations are those I have with theologians, authors, or pastors who can help us unpack what the Bible teaches us about migration so that our views about migration are shaped by the Word of God. In the third category of conversations, I invite you to listen to leaders who work with organizations or churches that cater to refugees or immigrants, so you can find inspiration and practical tips to reach out to immigrants and refugees. On occasion, I will also do solo episodes where I will share important truths about how embracing our identity as foreigners on earth can impact the way we live. So back to this first episode. Meet Dr. Kamalini Kumar. She grew up in poverty in India because her parents were refugees from Myanmar, but she did not let her circumstances keep her from pursuing her dream of becoming a nurse. Eventually, she became a nurse educator in both Canada as well as the US. What stood out to me in this story was how God led Dr. Kumar to combine her love for teaching and nursing with her love for the gospel. God can use us wherever He has placed us to accomplish His plans if we are available and obedient to Him. He has blessed us with particular strengths and talents and placed us in a particular circle of influence for a reason. We can find satisfaction and joy when we use our God-given gifts for His purposes and for the advancement of His kingdom. The story about how Dr. Kumar met her husband and how their marriage drew them closer to God and to each other over the years is fascinating and awe-inspiring. I'm certain you will enjoy getting to know this amazing woman of faith and strength. Her testimony will encourage you to put God first in your life and keep your eyes focused on Him. You can watch this conversation on my YouTube channel, Mabel Ninen. You can also join our private Facebook group to watch an extra scene where Dr. Kumar shares a special word of encouragement. And go to mabelninen.com for more information. This episode of Far From Home is brought to you by Migration Christian Conference. Are you curious about what the Bible says about God's heart for immigrants? Migration Christian Conference is excited to announce its fifth annual gathering on Saturday, June 24th, 2023 at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary in Boston, Massachusetts. This conference seeks to empower pastors and Christian leaders with tools to positively and proactively serve their immigrant communities and to mobilize Christian leaders into social action. Come and explore God's heart for immigrants and refugees in our world today by searching the stories of immigration throughout the Christian scriptures. Learn from pastors, scholars, and activists about what it means to care for the immigrants in the church, the academy, and the public square. To learn more, visit migrationchristianconference.com. Migration is spelled with a Y and not an I, MYGRATION. Again, go to migrationchristianconference.com for more information. Welcome to Far From Home with me, Mabel Ninen, your host. Our guest on this episode is Dr. Margaret Kamalini Kumar. I heard her share her story on an episode of the Story Night podcast, and I was inspired by her overflowing passion for serving God. And I was eager to have her as a guest on Far From Home because not only is she a godly woman, but she's also a first-generation immigrant. So I reached out to Jessica Campbell, the host of the Story Night podcast, and I got Dr. Kumar's contact information from her. So thank you, Jessica. If you're listening to this, thank you for the introduction. Now, Dr. Kumar has a long bio, but here are a few important facts about her. Born and raised in India, Dr. Kamalini Kumar completed her nursing degree from Christian Medical College Vellore in Tamil Nadu, which is one of the top medical schools in India. A registered nurse by profession, she retired from a long career of 47 years in nursing education, having taught at several universities in India, Canada, and the United States. She serves on several international boards, including Nurses Christian Fellowship International and the CMC Vellore Foundation in New York. She has traveled extensively throughout the world, speaking on professional and spiritual issues that impact nursing practice. Her passion is to teach nurses how to assess and give spiritual care to their patients and to share their faith in ways that are culturally appropriate. She also has an MA in instructional design and technology and a PhD in educational psychology from the University of Iowa. Dr. Kumar has been a citizen of the United States since 1976. She is widowed with two children and two grandchildren, and she now lives in Oregon to stay close to her son and his family. Welcome, Dr. Kumar. It's such a privilege and honor to have you as a guest on Far From Home.
Thank you, Mabel. It's my privilege and pleasure to be on the show, and thank you for asking me.
So for our guests, I'm just going to, you know, let you know that I will be calling her auntie because that's usually the traditional Indian way of addressing an elderly woman or someone much older than I am. So I will be calling her auntie. Don't be confused by that. We are not related.
We are, in a sense, related.
Yes. Yes, of course. So, auntie, you were born and raised in India, but your family's immigrant journey can be traced to Burma. Myanmar, what was once called Burma. So tell us more about your background.
Yes. So both my parents were born in Rangoon, which was the capital of Burma. My mother's family were second generation Christians converted from Hinduism. My father's family were Brahmins. They were not converted. And they lived, ironically, on the same street, but did not know one another at all. Then the war broke out, the Second World War, and the Japanese invaded Burma and were slaughtering the Indians and the English because we were allies of the British. And my grandfather on my mother's side worked for the British Army, so he was able to get a ship for the last ship coming to India and brought his family back home to Bangalore. My father's family, on the other hand, were not so fortunate. They just had to flee with the clothes on their back, trekking across the jungles of northeast India, that upper part of India and Burma, with his whole family. He had seven siblings and his mom and dad. And there were hundreds of Indians fleeing on that, and other members of my mother's family as well. My dad and mom were both 19 when this happened in 1942, 43, just finished high school. And that journey was horrendous to hear my father describe it. They literally starved for 4 months with nothing to eat. Many times just grass is what they ate. And so when they reached the border of India, outside of Calcutta, my dad and a sister, and I think one younger brother, were the only ones that survived. Everybody died along the way, just basically of starvation. And my dad had malaria. He was a 19-year-old, and, you know, the government brought them all down to the south because they were South Indians. And my dad, at age 19, with malaria, wandering around the streets of Bangalore, looking for a place to live and food to eat and a job. And he just happened to see my uncle, my mother's brother, on the street and recognized him as someone he had seen in Rangoon but didn't know. So he approached him and asked him, "Are you from Burma?" And my uncle said, "Yes." And my dad told him who he was, and he took him home to my grandfather's house. And that was the first time he saw my mother, who was also 19 at that time. And for some reason, there was chemistry right there. and they were attracted to each other. My dad very quickly wanted to marry her, but of course he was a Brahmin. And so my grandfather and others in the family insisted that he convert. So he converted to Christianity just to marry my mother. I don't think my father really had, I can't say for sure that he really had a true life conversion, you know. He read the Bible, he went to church, he did all those things, but his whole mindset was very Brahmin, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. He was a young man, both of them were 21 when they got married. And life was horrendously difficult because he had a job as an aircraft technician with HAL in Bangalore. Not well paying, and they had 5 kids in 7 years. I was the eldest. My childhood memories are a mixture of happiness. I mean, we never knew we were poor. We were dirt poor. Went hungry many, many times, went to bed hungry. Realized there was no food in the house. Or wore hand-me-down clothes and hand-me-down shoes. But my parents engendered in us a sense of pride, taught us the love of reading. And reading just expanded our horizons and took our minds away. I remember reading about the great composers, music composers of the world. I remember reading about skiing down mountains. And in my mind, I wanted to do all those things. But, you know, we were lucky because the good schools gave us a good discount on our education. We all did extremely well in school, and education was our way out. It truly was. I won a full scholarship to nursing school. My sister won a full scholarship to medical school. My other sisters also went to college, getting their master's. My brother was a banker. There were 4 girls and 1 boy. And so the cycle turned, and we were able to support our parents and, you know, be of help to them. My mother...
About your choice, Auntie, about your choice of choosing nursing.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, you know, I was the eldest, so I was caregiver naturally, and I found that I was extremely patient with my brothers and sisters. My brother and sisters, when they were sick, I was not so patient when they were not sick. I found that I was I felt more the ability to care for people when they were hurting. And I read a comic book about Florence Nightingale when I was 10 or 11, and that just sealed it for me. But it was such a difficult decision for my dad because he thought nursing was such a menial profession. And we had long and hard fights about that. And finally, I won and I said, I'm going to nursing school. And so he took me to Velo. And that's when he left me, he said, if you're unhappy, I don't want to hear about it. And I have never regretted that decision. I have absolutely loved being a nurse. And nursing still moves me to tears when I see the compassion and the care that so many nurses give.
Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about your faith. You said that your dad was not, you did not think he was a believer, but your mom was.
My mom sent us to, we went to the Anglican Church, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, the Pentecostal Church. We were in church all through Sunday, Saturday, Wednesday. My mom wanted to make sure that we were truly, you know, in imbibing the gospel. When I was 11, Billy Graham came to India on a crusade, and he preached about hell very strongly. And I remember when the altar call was given, I ran up because my whole motivation was, I do not want to go to this place called hell. And I accepted Christ in my heart just because I wanted to avoid hell. And that was an 11-year-old decision. I don't know that I took it seriously, but I do believe God took it seriously. And he kept me through my whole life with that choice. And then my parents joined a very legalistic house church where it was all rules and regulations and very stilted and very difficult. And so throughout my school and college days, this is the church that I went to. Did not do any growing. It was just abiding by the rules. Thought I was a Christian, read my Bible, prayed, did all the good things, but no fire in my heart, no empowerment of the Holy Spirit, just a good person.
Mm.
And that was the beginning of my faith walk.
Mm.
And then, as it happened, you know, things changed after that, and I can keep with my story. I want to stick with your questions.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell us about your move to Canada. Why did you move? And if you can remember, I know it was a long time ago, take us back to the first few days that you set foot on foreign soil. What did it feel like?
So that's another story within a story, this why I moved to Canada story. We don't have time for that. But I went to do some postgraduate studies in Montreal with the full intention of coming back to India. I was already admitted into the master's program at CMC. I landed there in March of 1971. In a sari with sandals and a sweater and nothing else. It had snowed 91 inches that winter. And the day that I landed, they had 22 inches more. The airport was shut down. I had laryngitis. I could not even talk. Somebody was supposed to meet me with the coat and hat and boots and, you know, help me, a friend of a friend. Of course, they didn't make it to the airport. That was my introduction from sunny, beautiful Bangalore to this freezing 20 below, 90 inches of snow on the ground. And I thought, I stood there in the airport and thought, what have I done? Why did I do this? And I got a cab, it happened to be an immigrant Greek man that was a cab driver. And he was so kind to me. And he drove me those 18 miles from the airport to where I was staying in the dorm on McGill University campus. It took us 3 hours to drive that. And he did not take any money from me because all I had was $8. That's all we were allowed. And I tell you, my journey into this new country was, I've thought about it. I've talked about it when I talk about cultural competence. Yeah, I was filled with euphoria first of being in this new place and seeing things I'd only seen in magazines, and so excited to see the beautiful shops and stores and the abundance of everything. But very soon, disillusionment set in because people started asking me questions that were, in my mind, ridiculous, you know, because they would say, "What, you're Indian, what tribe are you from?" Or they would say, how did you learn the language so fast? Do you have ice cream in your country? I mean, there were just so many questions that in my mind, I had some pretty smart, electy answers to give them, but I didn't do it overtly. And that disillusionment that people don't know anything about India, and I know so much about Canada. Why is that? They didn't even know where India was. And so that disillusionment became hostility. It became anger. And that displayed itself in extreme homesickness, crying every time I got a letter from India and wondering why I did what I did, and realizing I did not much care for this culture. And I began to do one thing that many immigrants do. they start to crucify the culture they've chosen to live in and deify their own culture. Like everything in India was wonderful. People respected elders and, you know, all kinds of positive things I would say about India, and all the while finding fault with Canada. And pretty soon I realized what a foolish thing that was to do, because nobody asked me to come here. I chose to come here. And I better look at the opportunities I have rather than go on this negative way of thinking. And there was a paradigm shift in my head. And I thought, my sense of humor has to come back. I just need to deal with this, where, you know, people don't know, genuinely don't know. They're asking because they don't know. Nobody wants to come and immigrate to India. Everybody wants to come from the East to the West. So naturally, we get to learn more about the country we're coming to. So I began to be more patient in answering questions and realized that there has to be an adaptation on my part as well as the majority culture I'm living in. Sometimes we as immigrants expect all the adaptation to happen with the majority culture. We have to change some of the ways we think also. We cannot do Indian standard time living in the West. You know, we have to adjust and adapt. So I began to do that, and I finally realized, the other thing I realized is God gave me an instant family when I left. I knew that the family of God was there to be my family, and I began to assimilate with them. So from adaptation, I went to assimilation. And I opened my home and I invited people to my home all throughout my years of living here. And I've lived here since 1971. I have as many American and Canadian friends as I have Indian friends. They've been in my home. I cook Indian food for them, just less than the chili, but they love it. And I've learned to be a bicultural woman. I can go back to India and be a total Indian housewife there. But, you know, I live here. And so I would encourage everyone not to stay. These are stages you go through. Mm-hmm. Not to settle in one of those stages. Yeah. But ask, why did God bring me here? What is the purpose he has for me? Mm-hmm. How can I be salt and light to everyone, not just the community I prefer?
Yeah. So beautiful, Auntie, the way you put it and the way you explained it. And I can relate to so much of what you said. In fact, you know, how you described the stages and what you went through is very similar to what I went through. And I talk about it in my book. So it's so good to hear, you know, you sharing that.
It is the journey of every immigrant. They only don't recognize this is happening to them. Yeah. And if they would stop and think, am I sitting in this hostility or anger? Or can I move forward? How do I adapt?
Yeah.
And is adaptation enough? How do I assimilate? Mm. How can I be a bicultural person? I think of Jesus, the most bicultural. He left the glory of heaven to come to this earth's culture.
Yeah.
And incarnate with us. Mm-hmm. And he's our example.
Yeah. And you point out rightly that that can be a blessing, that we see ourselves as bicultural. And that, to me, I always see it as a blessing of being an immigrant, is that I can be both Indian and American. And that way, you know, I see myself also as a bridge builder, a cultural interpreter, and I enjoy both cultures.
Yes.
I've come to that point where I can say I enjoy both cultures. I know good and bad from both. But again, the Bible is our benchmark, not culture. And so this, we can do a separate interview.
God's culture. We have to, you know, adjust to his culture. And we have the best of both worlds. We can take the best from our country and take the best from the country, our adopted country, and live that life that is exemplary, because we have the best from both worlds.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So moving on in your story, tell us about your love story, you know, the love of your life. How did you meet him? I know that you met him in Canada. So
Well, actually, he was in Chicago. He's also a CMC graduate. He was a vascular thoracic surgeon living in Chicago. And I was in Montreal, and he saw my name in an alumni newsletter that I was working in Canada. And so out of the blue, I get a postcard from him. Hi, I'm Suren Kumar. Do you remember me? How come you're not married yet? He wrote this on a postcard, and I wish I'd kept that postcard. I was so annoyed, I pitched it. And I said to my friend, look at the cheek of this man writing this on a postcard. And the next thing I knew, he was on my doorstep, drove 15 hours from Chicago to Montreal. I didn't know what to do with him. And I thought, okay, let's go out for coffee. And we went out for coffee. And he said to me, you know, I'm really curious. Why aren't you married yet? I was 26 at that time. And I said, what business is it of yours that I'm not married? He said, well, I know in school there were a lot of guys that liked you, so I thought by this time you would be married. And I said, half joking and half seriously, I said, when I meet a man that puts God first in his life, I'll marry that man. And he was quiet for a minute, and he said, I've never heard anyone say that before. And then he banged on the table and he said, I am going to marry you someday. And I just laughed at him. And he drove, that man drove for a whole year every weekend. He was off. He drove 15 hours to Canada to court me. And I was not sure this is what I wanted. And I just kept putting him off. And then finally, he wrote and asked my parents' permission to marry me, and I hadn't told my parents about him. So that was another story. But anyway, there came a time when I realized he was sincere and he was persistent. And so we did get married in Chicago in 1973, after 2 years of courting. And he was from the north, born in Lucknow, grew up in Aligarh. So he was a UPite and I was a Tamilian, and I didn't speak Hindi. I knew book Hindi, and he knew broken Tamil because he worked in Velo. So we couldn't speak any common language. We had to speak English to one another, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know. But he was a hardworking, extremely good surgeon, and one day, when our kids were maybe six and 7 years old, we had a crisis of faith because six of our closest and dearest friends were going through a divorce because each one of these men who were physicians were having affairs. Mm. And it made me extremely angry and extremely insecure and extremely unhappy that they were doing this to my friends, which made me project my anger, my insecurity on my husband. And so we fought all the time over little things, which we had never done before. But we did make a promise to each other on our wedding night that we would not go to bed and, you know, unresolved anger. We would make up. So one night, till 2 a.m, I don't even know what we were fighting about. And finally, he said, do you want me to leave you? And I started crying. And I said, that is exactly what I'm afraid of, that you will do to me what these men have done to their friends. And he said, I would never do that to you. I said, what guarantee do I have? And it struck me at that moment that we were physically compatible. We were emotionally compatible. We were intellectually compatible. We enjoyed the same things, etc. But spiritually, we were far away from each other, far away from God. And I said that to him. And he said, you're right. Get up. Get out of bed. Kneel here beside me. We both knelt down side by side. And that night, we committed our lives, our marriage, our children, our careers, everything. We committed it to Christ. And we went to bed, and he said to me, if I'm not in the hospital, if I'm not in the clinic, if I'm not in the operating room, I will call you to tell you where I am. I said, you don't have to. I trust you. Nothing changed, but I knew in my heart God had made this whole marriage whole. And 2 months later, my two little ones standing in the bathroom brushing their teeth, and my daughter with a toothbrush in her mouth, she said, do you think mom and dad are going to get divorced? And I stopped. I was like in shock that it came out of her mouth. And my son said, no, they won't get divorced. And she said, how do you know? And, you know, typical big brother. Oh, Sangeeta, you don't know anything. They're going to be fine. So she says, they won't do that. They love Jesus too much. And I thought, here are two little children watching our lives and seeing a change. If they can, this is where we have to be faithful within the home. There is no point having ministry outside if in within your home you're not showing the love of Christ to one another. That began a wonderful journey for both of us. 42 years. First, there was chemistry within between us. Then there was this compatibility. Then there was this codependency on one another. And finally, before he died, companionship. Mm-hmm. And I think of those C's. You know, since I'm a teacher, I think of ways I can remember things. That was our marriage. And right soon after that, we decided to have a Bible study in our home. And we invited 9 couples from 8 different churches to meet in our home. It was not just our church. And my husband and another friend co-led that Bible study for 35 years, every single week in our home.
Wow.
And we had judges and lawyers and doctors and nurses and housewives and firefighters and policemen and 2 ex-felons, one committed for murder and one for drug addiction in our Bible study. It was an amazing adventure.
And thank you, Auntie, for pointing out such an important truth that in a Christian marriage, Christ is the foundation. He is the head of the marriage. And when the husband and wife submit to him daily, that's when their marriage flourishes. And even individually, we thrive. Thank you for pointing that
out. And not that it was smooth, and not that I remember telling him once, I'm sick and tired of being a Christian. I want to give this up because I can't, I cannot keep being this. And he said, no one wants you to be perfect, you know, because I thought I had to never do anything that would be wrong that he would see or my children would see. And that was such a ridiculous way to live. So grateful for grace.
Absolutely. That Jesus really does not expect us to be perfect, but just obedient and faithful to him. And his grace, like you said, is sufficient for us. Now, going back to your nursing career, let's talk about that a little bit. And, you know, how it intersects with your faith.
Yes.
What led you to being a teacher, an educator? And then from there on, you also involved in so many organizations that teach healthcare professionals how to practice their faith. Tell us about that.
So I was pegged right from nursing college that I would be an educator. My dean said, you're going to work here for us for 3 years after you graduate, because I had a good command of the language and I could speak, and they figured that out. So that's what they told me I was going to do, is be a nurse educator, which I loved. I guess my thrill is to see light bulbs come on in people's heads as you're taking a complicated thing and breaking it apart and explaining it. It's just a wonderful thrill. So that was my track almost chosen for me. And as I look back and I look at the development of spiritual gifts and understand that that's what God blessed me with. And you know, as that the guy in Chariots of Fire said, God made me run, and I feel his pleasure when I'm running. So God helped me to teach, and I feel his pleasure when I do it. So that's the profession I chose, to be in nursing education. So all my education and my degrees were in education. But in 1988, a cousin of mine, the only other nurse in our family, by the way, we have about 8 or 9 physicians. She was the only nurse. She came to visit me and she challenged me. She said, how long have you been in nursing? I said, oh, too many years to count. How many nurses' practice have you changed? And I said, I hope a lot, because I teach. I hope I've changed people's practice. She said, how many nurses have you influenced for Jesus Christ? And I was stunned. I said, I don't think any. And she said, aren't you wasting your life? And I said, probably. And she said, come with me to this conference in Philadelphia. There's an organization called Nurses Christian Fellowship International, which at that time was part of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. And so I went there and I thought I was in heaven, because there were 600 nurses from 42 different countries all gathered together with the same intent of glorifying and honoring God in the profession of nursing. I had never seen anything like that before. And it just caught fire. And I thought, this is what I want to do. And somebody heard that I was a conference speaker, so they asked me at the next conference if I would be a speaker. And my journey took off from there, because I became very involved in speaking at various. We've divided the world into different parts, like Latin America, the Canadian and North America, Europe, Africa, the Central East, Middle East, and then the Far East. And so I spoke at national conferences, international conferences, regional conferences, and I became involved on the board. And then I became, for 16 years, I was on the board, and then I was the president of Nurses Christian Fellowship International. And the more involved I got, the more I thought, what a great opportunity to teach nursing courses like leadership or spiritual care or education, or any of the things we taught in secular nursing, to underpin them with biblical principles. So that's what I started to do. Started to create courses on various nursing topics, but underpinned with biblical principles. And so I began to do that. And then it became my passion that every Christian nurse realizes and understands that she's the heart and the eyes and the hands and the feet of Jesus, of someone lying flat on their back and looking up. Who do they see? The face of a nurse 24/7. Are they seeing Jesus? And how do we convey this to our patients and our colleagues? And then I became involved with an organization called International Health Services Global, which I don't know if you've heard of the SALIN program, but it's a witness training program that posits that every one of us are on a spiritual journey, from a skeptic to a child of God. And there are many phases we go through. And we, as witnesses, we're called to be witnesses. We're not called to harvest first. We're called to cultivate and sow and water and then harvest and then multiply. But so often we rushed to the harvesting without even understanding the barriers that people face. Yeah. You know, their intellectual barriers, their emotional barriers, their spiritual barriers. And so this course teaches us how to, you know, knock those barriers down and make it easy for one to progress from being a skeptic. So much of our work is hard work of cultivation and sowing.
Yeah.
Somebody else might do the same thing.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So teaching them how to do this culturally appropriate, teaching them the right questions to ask, how to share their faith without being pushy, how to just identify ourselves as children of God by just small, many things we might say. God helps me when I'm in trouble. You can say that to a patient. And if they say, how does he help you? Then they're giving you permission.
Mm.
But if they don't say anything, then you don't have permission. So you use permission, sensitivity, and respect. Mm. And that's what we teach to doctors and nurses.
Wow. And, you know, that is applicable to anyone listening,
yes.
I feel,
yes,
right?
Yes.
To have that, their permission to interact with respect and even sensitivity.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And you've been such a blessing, I'm sure, to so many nurses all around the world. And God has used you in a huge way to...
I'm very humbled to know that, knowing from where I came and the plans he had for me that I never dreamt for myself, dreamt that I would travel as much as I did, having never been on a train. Ever, all my childhood, even. I have to tell you, I'm a pretty good downhill skier. I've been skiing for like 35 years. Never dreamt that I would be a skier. You know, so those things that in my childhood were my dreams, God just opened doors for me.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. So I read a report, Auntie, recently that, and I don't know if these are accurate statistics, that 30% of physicians and surgeons in the U.S. are immigrants, and I'm sure a large proportion of nurses and other healthcare professionals also are foreign-born.
Yes.
So what would you say are their unique strengths? What are the strengths that they bring to the table? And also, on the other hand, what are the challenges do you think they face?
So I would say culturally, in our Eastern cultures, there's a great deal of respect for the elderly and people older than you. And this whole idea that we don't have the facilities to do so many tests and x-rays and all this stuff. So you are taught to listen to the patient. They would always tell us in Velo, the patient will tell you the diagnosis if you listen and examine him. You don't have to do all these 100 tests. So that's how we are taught to practice, especially in Christian institutions. So there is this empathy and sympathy and this listening and this respect that I think a lot of our foreign physicians bring to the table. There is a sense of not being hurried, you know, because doctors, time is money. That's a Western concept. Time is money. So you have to use your time productively, wisely. Whereas for most of us, you know, take the time to listen and to understand where the patient's coming from. And I know many of my friends that are physicians will tell the patients, you don't have to buy this expensive drug. You can find the generic drug in Walmart. It has the same, you know, these kinds of things. I don't think that that American physician will often do. This is my observation. I'm not saying this is fact, but I know enough physicians to know that, you know, they're very caring about more holistic, like how you're managing your finances and how can you afford this kind of thing. So I think there's that level of difference, a lot of conscientiousness. Not that other physicians are not. I'm just delineating differences. I think the challenges are always, though, you always have this sense that I have to prove myself. I have to prove that I can do it as well or even better than my colleagues because of the color of my skin or where I come from. I have to tell you, I've never felt that way. I have never allowed anyone to define me but God. Never. I don't care what you say about me behind my back or to my face. I know who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I would encourage people to think about, you know, not to let another human being's estimation or value of you put you in a box. God has made you a son or daughter of the King. That should be your value. The other thing I think is maybe language difficulties. Sometimes it's difficult to understand, not so much the language, maybe the accent. And so people feel frustrated and feel like they don't know what they're talking about. I think that would be a challenge for physicians from abroad, or nurses for that matter. And of course, there's always the racial prejudice and the bias. But I remember going into a patient's room once, and he just looked at me and he said, "You know, some of my best friends are Black people." I had to say that. I think he was reassuring me. I said, "That's very nice to know." I didn't get offended because I think he was trying to be nice to me. But in this day and age, that could be cause for a lawsuit. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Do you recall an instance where you faced discrimination or some interaction that not made you angry, but made you sad?
Well, like I said, you know, because I can express myself and people understand me, there was less discrimination against me because I could make myself heard and understood. But I do remember shopping in Chicago in Nordstrom's, you know, that one of the high end. I really wasn't shopping. I was looking and being followed very closely by the salespeople. Very closely. They were observing me lest I shoplift or something. And I said, so I turned around. I said, "Do you need anything?" She said, "What do you need?" And I said, "I'm just looking." She said, "Well, if you're just looking, you can't afford this store." And, you know, she was a salesperson and I was an educated person. So, but that was her perception of me. And I said, "Thank you very much. I didn't take any offense." But I did, I will tell you, at one point when I was delivering my baby, and I was a midwife. I took a midwifery course and I was a qualified midwife. And this nurse did not bother to find out anything about me or my education or whatever. She was speaking to me like a child, loud, and explaining this whole process of childbirth to me when I had delivered babies. And I remember even in the throes of pain of childbirth, I was so annoyed at her. that she was telling me about what was happening. But that was my own pride. But, you know, if you take the trouble to ask people the right questions and understand what they know and what they don't know, then you can treat them with dignity.
Absolutely. Such an important point, that all these perceptions, prejudices that people have about immigrants, if only they would build relationships with them, get to know them, and even just have a listening ear, an open mind, to make such a huge difference.
For us to ask the right question. You know, the questions I often ask my Western friends, where did your ancestors come from? And how did they adjust to this culture? Do you know the history of your family? Because someday, my great-great-grandchildren may not know the history of me. I want to make sure that gets passed down.
So don't
forget that we all came from somewhere else. And you do it in a kind fashion. You don't, like, knock them over it. But just remind them that, you know, we're all strangers and foreigners. And more especially in the family of God. We're all aliens.
Amen. Thanks for also reminding us that as immigrants, we too, especially as Christians, when we encounter these things, to respond with kindness, with grace, with generosity. It was such a pleasure talking with you, Auntie. I feel like we could have recorded at least three more episodes. And I know you keep saying you have stories inside the stories.
I do have stories within stories, and I talk too much.
Well, it's all good. We, I learned so much just from getting to know you, and it's been such an encouragement and inspiration. You have been an inspiration to me, and I hope that many of the viewers and listeners will also be inspired by your story to put God first in their lives, put God first in their marriages, in their careers, and allow God to use them and their gifts for His glory. Thank you so much.
Right. You are so welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us today on Far From Home, a podcast that encourages biblical perspectives on immigration and inspires faith in action. I'm your host, Mabel Ninen. I would like to invite you to join our private Facebook group, Far From Home Podcast, a place where you can share your thoughts and comments. I also share extra scenes and behind-the-scenes snippets on this Facebook group. I can't wait to meet you there and listen to what you have to say. If you want to know more about Far From Home or about me, go to mabelninen.com. Some episodes of this podcast are available in video format on my YouTube channel, Mabel Ninen. Be sure to check that out if you're interested in watching the interesting conversations I have with the guests on this podcast. Thanks again for listening, and I'm so glad you joined us today. Until next time, goodbye.